Hello and welcome to Runway Girl Network in Conversation, a deep dive into aviation and the passenger experience. I'm RGN Deputy Editor John Walton, and today I'm in conversation with Tim Robinson, the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace, the magazine of the Royal Aeronautical Society, based in London. Tim, welcome to In Conversation.
Thanks, John. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Fab to have you. How did you get involved in aerospace to begin with?
I think it's not being eyesight and not being maths, not being good enough to be a pilot, led me down this path and started working at the Royal Aeronautical Society in 2001 on their magazines, and somehow I'm still here.
Fantastic. We're certainly glad to have you. Today we're going to be talking about Brexit and the many issues that leaving the European Union is raising for the United Kingdom in the aerospace world. But first, thanks to our sponsor. In Conversation is brought to you by Bolteron, a Simona company, purveyor of high-performance thermoplastics for tomorrow's aircraft interiors. When you're next on the aircraft, while you draw the latch of your tray table, consider the texture and form of the tray, shaped specifically for your in-flight service convenience. That's Bolteron. Learn more at boltaron.com. So Tim, I've been watching the submissions to parliamentary committees this week from RAES representatives. Can you sum that up for us?
Okay, so today we had a parliamentary evidence session given to a parliamentary committee from the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy on the implications of Brexit to the aerospace industry. So we're talking here about aerospace in the whole, not just airlines, but also manufacturing, R&D, a bit of space flight. The witnesses there were Catherine Bennett, who's the senior VP Airbus UK. We've got Paul Everett, Chief Executive ADS, that's the trade lobby group. And we've got President-elect of the Royal Aeronautical Society, Simon Henley, which is where I'm from. And that is the professional membership organization. So it's a bit like the Law Society. We don't lobby for any particular trade or point of view, but we do try to provide a learned input. So what we saw today really was expert witnesses grilled by the committee on what the challenges were. There's obviously Airbus, Catherine Bennett from Airbus brought up the fact that they're committed to the UK, they do the wings here, they've invested a lot, but they are the position always has been that they are worried about the practical matters of what happens in transferring people, services and goods around Europe post-Brexit. Paul Everett from ADS said about the industry being in a holding pattern and waiting to see what happens. Simon Henley from the our president-elect was also talking about the fact that in the space industry, we'd already started to see ways in which UK-based companies were being cut out of EU space, future EU space sort of contracts and programs, because obviously, post-Brexit, we're not part of the EU anymore. So there's a lot to digest, a lot of good information from the committee, a lot of good questions asked, and a lot to kind of sort of take in.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, obviously the UK and the EU have a very integrated aviation sector right now. What are some of the key issues that they're going to have to be grappling with over the next, I mean, it's not really that long, it's just over a year now.
Well, I think this is one of the main issues. I mean, there's a lot of issues to unpick, and that is part of the problem of it is how do you let's take a look at the three main areas for a start. So the committee was kind of touching on talking about it in ways. So manufacturing. Production of wings and engines in the UK. The UK supplies components to the EU to build aeroplanes. That's the growing demand. It's a global market, so we're pretty well set up at the moment for that. I don't think that's a major sort of issue or challenge in itself. But what you have is an extra burden on companies like Airbus, companies like Rolls-Royce, when they want to shift staff or services or goods. You know, for example, Beluga Wings, that's a classic one. They've got these just-in-time services that go across Europe, and everything is kind of very, very efficient. And the idea of like a Beluga sitting around there waiting for someone to sign a customs form, you know, that's going to throw a spanner in the works for Airbus. Secondly, the second thing to look at is obviously airlines, which you guys are probably more interested in, is what happens post, you know, March 2019. You know, do airlines stop flying? Do we revert to the WTO? Does something else that could come in? What's the worst case scenario you have to look at? You know, the aircraft are suddenly not going to become unairworthy after March 2019. But aviation is such a highly regulated industry that you can't just sort of brush it under the carpet and say, oh, well, hang on, you know, we're not quite up to date with our paperwork. You know, can we take 6 months off while we get up to speed? And the third area, I think, is discounting space, is aerospace R&D, is what happens in the future. A lot of the investment decisions for today's products have already been taken. So you've got things like the A320neo coming out, A350. These products are already in the production line, and it's just a matter of building wings and building engines and building landing gear quicker and quicker, and getting them out of the door to cope with demand. The future aerospace R&D is that's where the interesting bit happens, is what happens in things like European Clean Sky 3, Horizon 2020, which were kind of EU investment R&D funds. How does the UK and its UK industry PLC, how does it, what future? Does it have to invest in its own R&D, or is there a way we can pay to get back in? Those are sort of three big kind of areas, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that manufacturing side of things is something that I'm watching relatively closely. Obviously, that's not exactly been an area of strength, shall we say, recently, on certain parts of the Airbus programme. What does a company like Airbus, which has, as you say, just-in-time manufacturing, what do they do? Do they build up a stock of wings in advance, so they have to create additional stock locally in the final assembly lines in Toulouse and Hamburg and Tianjin and now Mobile? What's the thinking there?
Well, building up a big stock of engines or wings only if it goes wrong. so we've all seen in the media about the line of A320neos without engines in Toulouse. You know, the Toulouse Gliding Club, as it's been
the no engine option. Yes.
Some wags have called it. And that's what happens when your supply chain gets out of sync with the production. And that's one of the one of the challenges I think they've been looking at is how to avoid that, and how to avoid that extra burden. You know, it's not insurmountable, but it's just an extra thing on top of everything else.
Yeah, and indeed, one of the things that I'm looking at is about the level of preparation by the UK and the UK government in terms of being able to do all the processing that it will now have to do separately from the EU. Whether that's, you know, holidaymakers queued up at Dover, or whether that's the fact that, as you say, your Beluga can't take off because it doesn't have the right piece of paper, and there aren't enough people to produce the pieces of paper. That's going to be a really interesting challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, really, if you're talking about things like aviation safety, let's talk aviation safety and EASA. Really, if you were doing it properly, you'd want to be sort of like planning this sort of 10 years previously, you know, a decade beforehand, in order to get that expertise. It's ironic that you know, the UK has been one of the driving forces behind the European Safety Agency, and that has done absolute wonders for aviation safety in Europe and wider. It's now, you know, the gold standard of aviation safety, along with the FAA. If you are certifying a commercial aircraft today, you need FAA certification. You need EASA certification. You don't go to, you know, Fiji, for example, and get the certification from them. Those are the two big ones you aim for. That is a big thing to keep that level of safety, especially also that people don't sort of underestimate is in the growth of air travel. You know, in the way in which air travel doubles every 15 years, we've been told that, you know, you see the stats, and it is organisations like EASA and the FAA that have helped keep the accident rate down.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm also got an eye on the air traffic control systems, which are, of course, increasingly integrated. And what happens if the UK systems and the EU systems start to diverge?
I think there's less of a worry about ATM and ATC. The reason being is the single European sky, the idea of a single European sky is still in the slow lane. So oddly, although many EU countries will happily share a currency, everyone still likes to hold on to their own airspace. So that, I think, is people have been pushing for more integration of airspace, and there's obviously the CSAR, the European Eurocontrols from CSAR program, and it's just kind of really, really kind of slowly moving at a glacial pace. I don't think we could kind of wake up in March 2019 and find everyone had gone to a different version of airspace. You know, airspace 2.0. We were left on airspace 1.0, and that wouldn't work. ATM, I think, is still very much a national service provider business, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in terms of EASA, other nations within the European area, I'm thinking the Norways, the Switzerlands, the Liechtensteins, are already part of EASA as a sort of affiliate member, aren't they? Is that sort of option open to the UK?
Yeah, I think that that we're one way forward, and I think if you were to if somebody were to come out and who was well above my pay grade and in a position of authority to say we're going to go down that route, we're going to be Switzerland or we're going to be Norway in EASA, that'd be very welcome. That would be, oh wow, you know, there'd be a sort of a collective sigh of relief around the aviation aerospace industry is, okay, this is how it works. You've obviously got different levels of involvement. You know, Switzerland is a member, but then there's kind of sort of various little other sort of levels below that. But you lose the influence. So UK is going to lose its influence in sort of setting standards and things like that, which was ironic, really, because UK and its expertise in aviation safety and certification, all the rest of it, was one of the driving forces behind EASA.
Yeah, indeed. Let's dive a little deeper into the safety side of things. As the UK leaves, let's assume that there isn't any agreement at this stage to bridge into EASA or something similar. What will the UK need to replicate in terms of aviation safety?
That is a very good question. You're looking at, As I said earlier, I mean, if you were going to do this properly, you would have started planning, 10 years previously. The CAA, for example, would have to expand tremendously. You'd have to invest in the CAA. The expertise is gone. It's not there at the moment. So how long would it take to regain this expertise? Is a good question, but the things you're looking at is you know, sort of type certification. You're looking at licenses. You're looking at a good example here was from Simon Henley at the parliamentary hearing, which I didn't really sort of think of, is that there are about 170 plus FAA certificated MRO facilities in the UK. So they are authorized to work on you know US aircraft with FAA tickets. The FAA is already planning worst case scenario from January 2018 that we are going to crash out of EASA, because that's what they've got to do. They've got to plan ahead and you know, sort of take that into account. So there's all these uncertainties. I mean, on the plus side, the message does seem to be getting through. You know, there are the right noises coming from Whitehall. There are right noises coming from government, but it's the devil in the detail. It's what have you missed? What are the? How do you untangle all of the different bits?
What was the response from the committee members, the parliamentarians, to these three pieces of evidence in particular?
Yeah, I mean, they were seemed sort of, you know, pretty clued up, pretty interested. They were certainly asking the right sort of questions you would ask. But some of them have some of them at the moment are in limbo. Some of them as Paul Everett said, you know, it's a holding pattern at the moment. The right. I think you know the they are aware of the issues. Put it this way, let's say Whitehall are aware of the issues, but I think maybe that there is a sort of, you know, there still needs to be a sort of a bit of a nudge on the urgency of some of them, because if we're talking about 2019, March 2019, and you will probably know this better than I do, and about sort of airlines planning, airline scheduling, and how far ahead that does. You know, March 2019 is coming pretty soon, and airlines like, you know, Ryanair, EasyJet, etc., BA, they've all got a plan well in advance about what are they going to do for their, you know, their summer schedules in March 2019. How are they going to manage it? So that aspect of it is there is a sort of a ticking clock going on, and it's getting more and more urgent.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what are British airlines doing in terms of trying to make those preparations?
Right. Well, I mean, some of them already been proactive. EasyJet, for example, has in the summer has going to open an AOC in Austria, so a new base in Austria. So basically, they'll be able to sort of you know, kind of use the European air operator certificate, you know, post, you know, March 2019. So I think, you know, some of them are already looking at this and looking at it from a sort of proactive standpoint as to perhaps we sort of start, you know, planning for the worst case. But it depends, you know, you've got the whole, depending on what happens, is there going to be some kind of interim agreement, which is obviously the industry is quite keen on, or is it just going back to WTO? How does this affect open skies with the US? You know, the transatlantic is obviously the I suppose you'd call it the golden goose that lays the eggs, the golden eggs. You know, what does that do to bilaterals with the US? All at the moment, sort of seemingly a little bit in limbo.
Yeah, and you know, I think we keep coming back to this issue of everything being in limbo and people just not being sure, which I suspect may surprise international listeners who assume that there has been a lot of planning for all of this thing. One of the issues, of course, that we're hitting as we, you know, stare down the barrel of the loaded Brexit gun is that, you know, we ended up at the end of the referendum vote last year with nobody really having any plans for this, which is obviously not an ideal situation to be in. In terms of negotiating open skies agreements and figuring that out, what's your take on whether the UK has the expertise in order to be able to do that? Or is that something else that needs to be hired in another process which will take up more time?
That's a good question. Yeah. Have we got the expertise? Well, it's another burden. It's another, gosh, didn't we think of this earlier? To think of question to look at. I honestly don't know on that one. I'm afraid. You would hope so.
Yeah, it doesn't exactly sound like the best thing to build a policy and significant national industry on. I mean, I grew up flying transatlantically between, you know, New York and London on that hourly British Airways shuttle, basically. And, you know, the UK has obviously been, you know, ceding its negotiation power, ability and expertise to EASA for so long that it will have to create its own somewhere. You know, whether that's the newly created Department of International Trade, or whether it's the BEIS, which is the Business, Energy, Industry and...
Industrial Strategy.
Business and Industrial Strategy, that's it. You know, it's these various parts of the Whitehall governmental machine sort of all hopefully working together, but it does leave us with some big questions, doesn't it, about what exactly needs to be done.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the flip side, I think let's play a sort of devil's advocate here. It's not all doom and gloom. So the UK has got, you know, second or third largest aerospace industry in the world, you know, second or third, depending on whether you talk to the French beforehand. Manufacturing, you know, there's great demand for sort of civil aviation at the moment. You know, it's going through the roof. That is not a problem. The sort of airlines, how they will keep flying, you know, I'm sure somebody will find a way, you know, and especially if MPs are have their minds concentrated over the past of the next sort of, you know, sort of until March 2019 by constituents who are suddenly sort of like waking up to the fact that you know, they might be able to not get onto an EasyJet flight or for the same price maybe, or the you know, there are reports, media reports coming out that say that it's going to be you know, sort of planes will stop flying, you know, maybe an exaggeration, maybe accurate, I don't know. And there are also some weirdly, I mean, I was talking to at Dubai Air Show, that there was people who think there's going to be some good opportunities. The chief commercial officer from Leonardo speaking there at Dubai, he was positive about it. He thought there were some risks about the R&D. But Leonardo, they're a big player in defence, in helicopters, all rest of it, and BAE Systems on the military side of aerospace. They're not really affected. They've got bilaterals with France, but they are, you know, they're involved with JSF, and they're not really sort of seeing any major sort of, you know, sort of, I would say sort of challenges from it in that respect. So. It's important to sort of keep it in perspective as well.
Yes, I mean that's certainly true. I mean, Leonardo is the old Augusta Westland operation in Somerset and elsewhere, if memory serves. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, they were very heavily pushing for the Remain vote, and it's interesting that they're now singing to a different hymn sheet, I think, from the one they were singing in June last year, where it was all, you know, the fact that it was going to cause them many fairly serious issues. In terms of that R&D that they're talking about, though, obviously one of the things that we talk about on Rumnagel Network quite a bit is getting the you know, a diverse and international pipeline going. What are the implications for the UK in those terms?
In the R&D, well, this is going to be the big kind of bun fight coming up in future R&D and how that gets allocated, what access the UK will have or UK firms. So, for example, you know, Clean Sky 3, the next sort of European civil aerospace R&D program, that, you know, normally would have, you know, you'd want people like, you know, GKN, Rolls-Royce taking part in that. What happens beyond Brexit is going to be interesting. Some companies have already made noises about how they are more European companies. They've highlighted their European facilities and their European factories on the basis that hey, we've got, you know, we're employing so many, so you know, our HQ may be in UK, but we're employing all these people in Germany, France, what have you, to kind of to sort of justify it that way. So that might be one thing. Oh, and another way in to future European R&D projects might be just to pay your way in, and it also might be a case of the people organising or the EU might decide in certain circumstances that it's okay to turn a blind eye and to sort of say company X is actually German if it suits a particular project, and if it's going to suit that particular sort of research program, so you might find that in the future. The alternative is what the UK really needs to do is, if that's not the kind of case, we're not going to have the same sort of access to these R&D programs, and also, you know, universities and sort of skills it really needs to kind of think about boosting its own internal, you know, own national R&D programs. Now, we've already made a start on that with the ATI, the Aerospace Technology Institute, which is kind of 50-50 industry, government, long-term research projects on civil aerospace applications. That, I think, you know, it was one of the areas where government or Whitehall may want to look at and to boost into improving UK's competitiveness post Brexit, so as that it's still going to be a good place for European companies to still do business with, invest in, what have you, but also on the wider world, in the US as well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I guess one of the questions though is where does that come from? Does this come out of that famed Boris Johnson standing next to a bus with £350 million a week going to the EU standing on it? Is that the pot which they would have to be replacing?
No, I think with the ATI is for long-term research projects. So it was basically recognizing that there was the UK had been living off its I forget the exact phrase here, but you know, past glories. So research done in the 1990s and 1980s, the aerospace is a long, long, long cycle industry where you do a bit of research and, you know, 20, 30 years later, it shows up in an airplane. So there was a recognition there that we'd been living off the past glories, past investments, and we now started to need to make more of an effort to invest in future technology. So the sums they're talking about, they're not huge mega sums, but that kind of seed corn funding, also matched by industry, that and it's the long term stability that industry really likes, is that this is a program we can put money into, government's going to put money into, and it's kind of ring fenced in that, all right, the following government isn't going to turn around, isn't going to kind of rock up and go, TSR2, we're cancelling that. So it's something that they can have weirdly enough, there were people in France looking at this with quite a little sort of bit of envy on the continent, looking, oh, that actually, you know, the this was quite a good sort of idea model to follow.
But it seems to me, Tim, and I'm not sure if I've missed something somewhere, that no one really knows the total sum that the UK government will have to replace if they are cut off from EU funding, if there's no agreement. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's cut off from EU funding in R&D.
So for example, if at the end of next March, everything just comes to a grinding halt, and for whatever reason, the EU says no, you can't buy your way back into these projects. What's the amount that needs to be replaced, let alone increasing, but just to maintain the steady state of this sort of R&D investment?
Again, I don't know offhand, I'm afraid.
No, fair enough. It sounds like this is another one of those problems that we haven't even really scoped the full extent of yet.
Yeah, no, there is a sort of like a head. There is a headline figure for, like, you know, Horizon 2020 if you look it up, or you know, Clean Skies 3. So apologies, yeah, I don't know if off the top of my head.
Fair enough. One of the issues that we look at quite a bit is getting the right mix of people into organisations, and particularly into aerospace organisations. Have there been any discussions around some sort of special visa for industry sort of arrangements? Are there going to be some sort of aerospace specific or aerospace category visa to ensure that this priority industry is one that can be maintained in terms of the expertise that it's able to attract, not just from the EU, but worldwide?
I think you've hit on a very important point in terms of that is sort of underappreciated in terms of skills and workforce mobility, and also encouraging people into the industry. In the big global aerospace firms, if you join Airbus, or if you join Rolls-Royce, or if you join Company X, one of the key attractions is you will get to, as part of your career development, you will get to move around to different places. You'll have to, you know, sort of 2 years in Toulouse. And that's one of the one of the issues that really needs to be looked at is the sort of skills. I mean, the problem is obviously this runs against freedom of movement. Is one of the things that the kind of arch Brexiteers have been arguing against in terms of sort of economic migrants. But there's obviously a difference between a highly skilled Airbus engineer and somebody who is sort of just off the boat from, you know, kind of wherever, you know. I think that's a really, really good point about, the workforce mobility and the opportunities, the global aerospace industry offers to young people and to sort of staff. You know, maybe it won't. It's not going to sort of stop it completely, but it will. Again, it's another burden. It's another a barrier. It's another something else there in the way to kind of get in the way. Whereas previously it was, join Company X, see the world.
Yeah, and one of the things that I noted with a lot of interest in the RAS's submission to this committee today was that in a lot of particularly international companies, having had international experience is something that is not even a nice to have on a senior executive recruiting form these days. It's an absolute must. And of course, that'll be very tricky if a generation or three or four generations of British management teams go through, even if it takes a couple of years to sort this out and then it's all hunky-dory. But there'll be a couple of years that people are now behind their international counterparts in terms of having had that expertise and experience. Whether that's a CV box ticking exercise or whether that's, you know, actually in many ways having useful experience to draw from in that way.
Completely right. Yeah, I mean the mobility. I mean, aerospace is a global industry, and we sort of take it for granted that you would move from job to job, and you'd have this sort of ability to move wherever you want to work. And interestingly, it's not something that's kind of happened overnight or even particularly kind of connected to the EU in a way. You think of some of the people, you know, one of Boeing's first hires was a Chinese engineer, an aeronautical engineer. You think of other people who one of the in the industry who made their mark outside their home nation, working for somebody else. You know, there are plenty of examples of that. So it's going to have a sort of danger is that it's going to have an effect on the attractiveness of aerospace careers in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any good news that we have on this sort of topic, Tim? What's the potential upside? Is it a greater involvement with developing nations? Is it a closer partnership with the United States and China and non-EU nations? Is there anything there that we can talk about that's got a little bit of a rosier picture to it?
Well, I think some of the airlines, you know, some of the UK flagged airlines might be particularly interested in getting rid of the EU's compensation scheme. Let's put it this way, for the sort of delays and delays on passenger rights, they'd be interested in the fact that might be potentially, potentially they might be able to kind of say, well. Air traffic delays by weather, acts of God, air traffic control. It's no longer our fault, and we don't have to pay up to passengers. That might be one.
I'm not sure from a PaxEx perspective, Tim. That's really a plus.
Well, good for the airlines. There's other little bits of legislation. I think that some people in certain sectors and certain niches would say, we might be better off ditching. For example, in the VIP helicopter charter industry, they were chomping at the bit because they had. New rules brought in, which were aimed from EASA, which were aimed really at the offshore oil and gas industry, and they were stuck in a sort of like a put in a certain box where the pilots could never get the experience or the qualifications to move on to the next sort of license or the next stage. There's a little bit of an involved story, but basically, they were sort of saying that some of the operators there were angry about the EASA. Global opportunities could be. It's also needs to remember that Airbus has, in dealing with, parts of it outside the EU. Airbus has a foul in Alabama, US, has a foul in China. It goes where the market is. If the skills and the investment is there, then people are still going to want to do business with the UK. They still want to invest in the UK. I think what the ultimate conclusion really is that the UK has now got to really up its game even more. We're going to be out of the club, and you can't take it for a given that okay we're 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 in the EU, therefore we should get X amount of work just by being in the EU. I mean, that was changing anyway, but the competition between ourselves and companies within the EU, companies without the EU, on providing engines, wings, etc. to the rest of the world has just kind of gone up a gear. So UK industry has really got to kind of up its game to in competitiveness and efficiency to kind of cope with this.
Well, absolutely. That's the conclusion I'm rapidly coming to as well. But thank you, Tim. This has been a really, if not inspiring, certainly a sobering and thought-provoking conversation. Listeners, we hope you enjoyed it, and we're always keen to find out what you think. Please feel free to email me at john@runwaygirlnetwork.com with any suggestions. Thank you to our guest, Tim Robinson. Tim, where can our listeners find you?
Okay, you can find me tweeting at RESTimR, or you can go to the Royal Aeronautical Society website at www.aerosociety.com.
Fantastic. As ever, you can find me on Twitter at ThatJohn, and everything from RGN on Twitter at RunwayGirl and at RunwayGirlNetwork.com. Thanks for listening.